Chapter 21.
I, sir, said Tom, falling in two-step behind his officer. Bit of palaver, as two courses and distances can do no harm. I crossed the broadest part of Cuba by the help of my tongue, though knowing far less Spanish than I do now. As they say themselves, it was four words, and no more with me, that time when I got left behind on shore by the Blanche frigate. He made light of what was before him, which was but a day's journey into the mountains. It is true that there was a full day's journey before striking the mountain path, but that was nothing for a man who had crossed the island of Cuba on his two legs, and with no more than four words of the language to begin with. The officer and the man were walking now on a thick sodden bed of dead leaves, which the peasants thereabouts accumulate in the streets of their villages, to rot during the winter for field manure. Turning his head, Mr. Byrne perceived that the whole male population of the hamlet was following them on the noiseless springy carpet. Women stared from the doors of the houses, and the children had apparently gone into hiding. The village knew the ship by sight, afar off, but no stranger had landed on that spot perhaps for 100 years or more. The cocked hat of Mr. Byrne, the bushy whiskers and the enormous pigtail of the sailor, filled them with mute wonder. They pressed behind the two Englishmen staring like those islanders discovered by Captain Cook in the South Seas. It was then that Byrne had his first glimpse of the little cloaked man in a yellow hat. Faded and dingy as it was, this covering for his head made him noticeable. The entrance to the wine shop was like a rough hole in a wall of flints. The owner was the only person who was not in the street, for he came out from the darkness at the back, where the inflated forms of wineskins hung on nails could be vaguely distinguished. He was a tall, one-eyed Asturian with scrubby, hollow cheeks. A grave expression of countenance contrasted enigmatically with the roaming restlessness of his solitary eye. On learning that the matter in H. and was the sending on his way of that English mariner toward a certain Gonzales in the mountains, he closed his good eye for a moment, as if in meditation. Then opened it, very lively again. Possibly. It could be done. A friendly murmur arose in the group in the doorway at the name of Gonzales, the local leader against the French. Inquiring as to the safety of the road, Byrne was glad to learn that no troops of that nation had been seen in the neighborhood for months. Not the smallest little detachment of these impious polizons. While giving these answers, the owner of the wine shop busied himself in drawing into an earthenware jug some wine which he set before the heretic English, pocketing with grave abstraction the small piece of money the officer threw upon the table in recognition of the unwritten law that none may enter a wine shop without buying drink. His eye was in constant motion, as if it were trying to do the work of the two, but when Byrne made inquiries as to the possibility of hiring a mule, it became immovably fixed in the direction of the door, which was closely besieged by the curious. In front of them, just within the threshold, the little man in the large cloak and yellow hat had taken his stand. He was a diminutive person, a mere homunculus, Byrne describes him, in a ridiculously mysterious, yet assertive attitude, a corner of his cloak thrown cavalierly over his left shoulder, muffling his chin and mouth, while the broad-brimmed yellow hat hung on a corner of his square little head. He stood there taking snuff, repeatedly. A mule, repeated the wine seller, his eyes fixed on that quaint and snuffy figure. No, senior officer. Decidedly no mule is to be got in this poor place. The coxswain, who stood by with the true sailor's air of unconcern in strange surroundings, struck in quietly, "If your honor will believe me, Shank's pony's the best for this job. I would have to leave the beast somewhere, anyhow, since the captain has told me that half my way will be along paths fit only for goats." The diminutive man made a step forward, and speaking through the folds of the cloak which seemed to muffle a sarcastic intention, "Sigh, senior, they are too honest in this village to have a single mule amongst them for your worship's service. To that I can bear testimony. In these times it's only rogues, or very clever men who can manage to have mules, or any other four-footed beasts, and the wherewithal to keep them. But what this valiant mariner wants is a guide. And here, senor, behold my brother-in-law, Bernardino, wine cellar, and alcalde of this most Christian and hospitable village, who will find you one. This, Mr. Byrne says in his relation, was the only thing to do. A youth in a ragged coat and goatskin breeches was produced after some more talk. The English officer stood treat to the whole village, and while the peasants drank, he and Cuba Tom took their departure accompanied by the guide. The diminutive man in the cloak had disappeared. Byrne went along with the coxswain out of the village. He wanted to see him fairly on his way, and he would have gone a greater distance, if the seaman had not suggested respectfully the advisability of return so as not to keep the ship a moment longer than necessary, so close in with the shore on such an unpromising-looking morning. A wild gloomy sky hung over their heads, when they took leave of each other, and their surroundings of rank bushes and stony fields were dreary. In 4 days' time, were Byrne's last words, the ship will stand in, and send a boat on shore, if the weather permits. If not, you'll have to make it out on shore the best you can till we come along to take you off. Right you are, sir, answered Tom, and strode on. Byrne watched him step out on a narrow path. In a thick pea jacket with a pair of pistols in his belt, a cutlass by his side, and a stout cudgel in his hand, he looked a sturdy figure and well able to take care of himself. He turned round for a moment to wave his hand, giving to Byrne one more view of his honest bronzed face with bushy whiskers. The lad in goatskin breeches looking, Byrne says, like a fawn or a young satyr leaping ahead, stopped to wait for him, and then went off at a bound. Both disappeared. Byrne turned back. The hamlet was hidden in a fold of the ground, and the spot seemed the most lonely corner of the earth, and as if accursed in its uninhabited desolate barrenness. Before he had walked many yards, there appeared very suddenly from behind a bush the muffled-up diminutive Spaniard. Naturally Byrne stopped short. The other made a mysterious gesture with a tiny hand peeping from under his cloak. His hat hung very much at the side of his head. Senor, he said without any preliminaries. Caution. It is a positive fact that one-eyed Bernardino, my brother-in-law, has at this moment a mule in his stable. And why he who is not clever has a mule there? Because he is a rogue. A man without conscience. Because I had to give up the macho to him to secure for myself a roof, to sleep under and a mouthful of Allah, to keep my soul in this insignificant body of mine. Yet, senor, it contains a heart many times bigger than the mean thing which beats in the breast of that brute connection of mine of which I am ashamed, though I opposed that marriage with all my power. Well, the misguided woman suffered enough. As he had her purgatory on this earth, God rest her soul. Byrne says he was so astonished by the sudden appearance of that sprite-like being, and by the sardonic bitterness of the speech, that he was unable to disentangle the significant fact from what seemed but a piece of family history fired out at him without rhyme or reason. Not at first. He was confounded, and at the same time he was impressed by the rapid forcible delivery, quite different from the frothy excited loquacity of an Italian. So he stared, while the homunculus letting his cloak fall about him, aspired an immense quantity of snuff out of the hollow of his palm. A mule, exclaimed Byrne, seizing at last the real aspect of the discourse. Who say he has got a mule? That's queer. Why did he refuse to let me have it? The diminutive Spaniard muffled himself up again with great dignity. Queen Sabe, he said coldly, with a shrug of his draped shoulders. He is a great politico in everything he does. But one thing your worship may be certain of, that his intentions are always rascally. This husband of my defunct sister ought to have been married a long time ago to the widow with the wooden legs. One, I see. But remember that, whatever your motives, your worship countenanced him in this lie. The bright unhappy eyes on each side of a predatory nose confronted Byrne without wincing, while with that testiness which lurks so often at the bottom of Spanish dignity, no doubt the senior officer would not lose an ounce of blood if I were stuck under the fifth rib, he retorted. But what of this poor sinner here? Then changing his tone. Eener, by the necessities of the times I live here in exile, a Castilian and an old Christian, existing miserably in the midst of these brute Asturians, and dependent on the worst of them all, who has less conscience and scruples than a wolf. And being a man of intelligence I govern myself accordingly. Yet I can hardly contain my scorn. You have heard the way I spoke. A caballero of parts like your worship might have guessed that there was a cat in there. What cat? Said Byrne uneasily. H, I see. Something suspicious. No, senor. I guess nothing. My nation are not good guessers at that sort of thing, and, therefore, I ask you plainly whether that wine cellar has spoken the truth in other particulars? There are certainly no Frenchmen anywhere about, said the little man with a return to his indifferent manner. Or robbers ladrons. Ladrons and grand no. Assuredly not, was the answer in a cold philosophical tone. Had is there left for them to do after the French? And nobody travels in these times. But who can say? Opportunity makes the robber. Still that mariner of yours has a fierce aspect, and with the son of a cat rats will have no play. But there is a saying too, that where honey is there will soon be flies. This oracular discourse exasperated Byrne. In the name of God, he cried, tell me plainly, if you think my man is reasonably safe on his journey. The homunculus, undergoing one of his rapid changes, seized the officer's arm. The grip of his little H hand was astonishing. Senor, Bernardino had taken notice of him. What more do you want? And listen, men have disappeared on this road, on a certain portion of this road, when Bernardino kept a mizen, an inn, and I, his brother-in-law, had coaches and mules for hire. Now there are no travelers, no coaches. The French have ruined me. Bernardino has retired here for reasons of his own after my sister died. They were three to torment the life out of her, he and Erminia and Lucilla, two aunts of his all affiliated to the devil. And now he has robbed me of my last mule. You are an armed man. Demand the macho from him, with a pistol to his head, senor, it is not his, I tell you, and ride after your man who is so precious to you. And then you shall both be safe. For no two travelers have been ever known to disappear together in those days. As to the beast, I, its owner, I confide it to your honor. They were staring hard at each other, and Byrne nearly burst into a laugh at the ingenuity and transparency of the little man's plot to regain possession of his mule. But he had no difficulty to keep a straight face, because he felt deep within himself a strange inclination to do that very extraordinary thing. He did not laugh, but his lip quivered, at which the diminutive Spaniard, detaching his black glittering eyes from Byrne's face, turned his back on him brusquely with a gesture and a fling of the cloak which somehow expressed contempt, bitterness, and discouragement all at once. He turned away and stood still, his hat aslant, muffled up to the ears. But he was not offended to the point of refusing the silver duro which Byrne offered him with a non-committal speech, as if nothing extraordinary had passed between them. I must make haste on board now, said Byrne then. Vaya usted con Dios, muttered the gnome. And this interview ended with a sarcastic low sweep of the hat which was replaced at the same perilous angle as before. Directly the boat had been hoisted, the ship's sails were filled on the offshore tack, and Byrne imparted the whole story to his captain, who was but a very few years older than himself. There was some amused indignation at it, but while they laughed they looked gravely at each other. A Spanish dwarf trying to beguile an officer of His Majesty's Navy into stealing a mule for him, that was too funny, too ridiculous, too incredible. Those were the exclamations of the captain. He couldn't get over the grotesqueness of it. Incredible. That's just it, murmured Byrne at last in a significant tone. They exchanged a long stare. He's as clear as daylight, affirmed the captain impatiently, because in his heart he was not certain. And Tom, the best seaman in the ship for one, the good-humoredly deferential friend of his boyhood for the other, was becoming endowed with a compelling fascination, like a symbolic figure of loyalty appealing to their feelings and their conscience, so that they could not detach their thoughts from his safety. Several times they went up on deck, only to look at the coast, as if it could tell them something of his fate. It stretched away, lengthening in the distance, mute, naked, and savage, veiled now and then by the slanting cold shafts of rain. The westerly swell rolled its interminable angry lines of foam, and big dark clouds flew over the ship in a sinister procession. I wish to goodness you had done what your little friend in the yellow hat wanted you to do, said the commander of the sloop late in the afternoon with visible exasperation. Do you, sir? Answered Byrne, bitter with positive anguish. Wonder what you would have said afterwards? Why, I might have been kicked out of the service for looting a mule from a nation in alliance with his majesty. Or I might have been battered to a pulp with flails and pitchforks, a pretty tale, to get a broad about one of your officers, while trying to steal a mule. Or chased ignominiously to the boat, for you would not have expected me to shoot down unoffending people for the sake of a mangy mule. And yet, he added in a low voice, I almost wish myself I had done it. Before dark, those two young men had worked themselves up into a highly complex psychological state of scornful skepticism and alarmed credulity. It tormented them exceedingly, and the thought that it would have to last for 6 days at least, and possibly be prolonged further for an indefinite time, was not to be borne. The ship was therefore put on the inshore tack at dark. All through the gusty dark night she went towards the land, to look for her man, at times lying over in the heavy puffs, at others rolling idle in the swell, nearly stationary, as if she too had a mind of her own to swing perplexed between cool reason and warm impulse. Then just at daybreak a boat put off from her, and went on tossed by Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.